So mitzvah shin samech vav 366 shalolita in shemen bekorban sota. We should not put oil in the offering of a sota. So during the procedure of a suspected adulteress, when she's brought to the Beis Hamikdash after her husband does the kinui, officially expresses his jealousy between her and a certain man, and then they are secluded together. They come to the Beis Hamikdash. They have to do the whole procedure. So part of the procedure is that the kohen puts a meal offering on her hands. We pointed out that it's intrinsic, that if a woman does not have hands or they're misshapen, that she cannot hold the offering with both hands, then she cannot be subject to the sota ordeal. So you put the offering on her hands, and the one difference between this mincha, this meal offering, and the other meal offerings in the Torah is that you do not put oil. Normally in the mincha offerings you put oil, which of course in the Middle East, you don't have to specify oil means olive oil. Not if there were a Torah, we're based on English, we're in France, we'd be butter, but in the Middle East, the standard oil is olive oil. So you shouldn't put oil in this offering. That you want her korban to be as bare bones as possible. You don't want, in other words, if you were eating this this meal offering, and the case of the sota, it's not eaten. Some meal offerings are eaten, but if it were eaten, then you would want the oil in it because it would be much tastier. Bread that's made with just flour and water is much less tasty than bread that has oil in it as well. Yeah.
Is the prohibition against a woman, a married woman, going with her hair bare? Does that depend on the sota's having to take off her hair covering?
That's the allusion to it in the Chumash. It's not mentioned in the Torah as such as thou shalt not uncover thy hair, but it's alluded to in the mitzvah sota that during the sota procedure we do things that indicate improper behavior on the part of a Jewish woman. So one of the things that they do in the sota procedure is that they publicly degrade her by ripping off her her head covering and loosening her hair. They also, rip her garments that should appear disheveled. So these are not things that Jewish women should normally be doing. They should be going with complete garments, and they should be going with a head covering. That's how we derive it from sota.
From sota, there's no other source.
There is no other allusion in the Chumash per se, no. But that's what Chazal say in Maseches Ksuvos on Daf Ayin Beis, that the Mishnah lists things that if a woman does, she can be divorced without being paid her ksuba. That ksuba, as we know,
covering her hair is one of
yeah. So if the idea is that ksuba is a protective document, that that it's a financial obligation to the wife, that in the event of a divorce, also contains provisions from the husband's estate should the husband die, but in the event of a divorce especially, then the husband has to pay the ksuba, has to pay her a certain sum of money, which would make him think twice about divorcing her. So, however, if she does things that we would like the husband to divorce her because she's really behaving improperly, then the ksuba doesn't apply. The ksuba is waived and the husband is free to divorce her without paying the ksuba. So one of the things is if she's not sufficiently religious, that the Mishnah lists things that if she doesn't keep kosher, she feeds her husband even produce that's not properly tithed, if she does not observe the laws of Nida properly, and one of the things that in addition to things that are an explicit violation of religious law that would affect her husband in a direct manner. So one of the things is that if she does not dress with snias, that if she doesn't dress modestly, then we would like her husband to divorce her because she's not acting in the proper way of a Jewish woman. So if he divorces her, the ksuba is waived and he doesn't have to pay the ksuba. So one of the things that's listed on the list is that if she goes out and without a hair covering, then she can be divorced without paying her ksuba. So then the Gemara discusses that the source for this is the sota, that is the biblical source, that the proper conduct for a Jewish woman, we assume it's a married woman because it's talking there in the Mishnah Ksubas about a married woman being divorced without her ksuba. It doesn't say that explicitly, interestingly enough, that it seems from certain Rishonim, like the Rambam, it seems that unmarried women also have to cover their hair. Perhaps the rules are not as stringent, maybe you know, just for example, you know, I'm not saying this is exactly accurate according to each individual Rishon Shita, but something like, you know, maybe an unmarried woman only has to cover her hair when she goes out into a real public marketplace, whereas, let's say, in a courtyard, which is shared by a few houses, only a married woman would need to cover her hair. Right, so as a sort of zecher to this, this isn't really what the Rambam means probably, but the Magen Avraham writes that he thinks that, which is true, that another usage of the word Rosha Parua, that her head is uncovered or undone, so the standard meaning, at least in Chazal, is that it means uncovered. But there's an additional meaning, which is expressed in Sota as well, that it means that the braids are loose. Braids are loose. If you in ancient societies, perhaps even up to like, I don't know, 120, something like that, 8 years ago. So it was very common in basically all societies for all women to wear their hair very long, and it would be pinned up when they appeared in public, even if it wasn't covered, even if, you know, they had guests in their house, it would always be pinned up, and it would basically only be let down. To flowing loose, right, in the presence of her husband. It indicated a certain sexual intimacy, which is why the Magen Avraham suggests, based on a stira in the Rambam, which may not really be a contradiction, but whatever it is, so he suggests that even if an unmarried woman do not have to cover their hair, maybe they should adhere to the other definition, which is that they should always have their hair in braids or put up. That it shouldn't be, they shouldn't have their hair flowing loose. So most disagree with this. There's no such halacha, and an unmarried woman, girl, could have her hair even flowing loose. Obviously, you know, in a modest way. That if her hair is, you know, very voluptuous and is going down to her, you know, waist. So then that maybe is not appropriate. But yeah.
Well, okay, it's shidduchim and also there's no market, but yeah. She's still in the market, so she wants to look her best. And
there's a, yeah, okay, but
your hair looks nice. Yeah.
I'm sure if she wore a miniskirt, maybe she'd also be looking her best.
No,
but it's not a proper Jewish man should not be looking for a woman who's wearing a miniskirt.
It should be noted, by the way, that in ancient times, people did not bathe very often, you know, generally, and so hair usually was probably best left under some kind of covering.
Or at least part off.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's why they take it down for their husbands in the bedroom.
Well, it's a little lights out. I don't know.
You know. Okay. Is it generally accepted that in the courtyard she's allowed to have her hair uncovered?
It's a machlokes rishonim.
But dafka in the courtyard, you're with your neighbors that you know, and there's perhaps more likelihood of developing intimacy with people that you see all the time.
There are two dinim over here. One din is exposure of body parts that should not be exposed, and one din is proper comportment.
Okay.
So, for example, if a woman goes out in public with, I don't know, what's a good example? I'm not paskining, I'm just giving an example in certain communities. If a woman goes out in public with a t-shirt, even if it's a long sleeve t-shirt, that, you know, whatever covers goes to here, whatever. Right, if she has a long sleeve t-shirt, so in many Jewish communities, that would be considered inappropriate. That's too casual, that a woman needs to appear in public only with a blouse or, you know, something more formal. So even though she's technically covering all the body parts that need to be covered with the t-shirt, and if in Borough Park, or even some even less stringent communities than that, it would simply not be appropriate for a woman to appear in public with a t-shirt. So regarding the courtyard versus the public domain, so, you know, there's a certain comportment involved, so that a woman may be appropriate for a woman to, you know, walk in the hallways of her apartment building with a t-shirt and nobody will bat an eyelash. But if she goes out to Bennett Avenue with just a t-shirt, even if she's covered, so that would be considered inappropriate. So the same thing, would be with regarding hair covering. So according to some Rishonim. There's no requirement for a woman to cover her hair in a private area, even a private-ish area within her own house or within a courtyard, private courtyard, but only when she goes in public. So the same thing, according to others, according to other Rishonim, it doesn't mean that a woman's allowed to go completely bareheaded in in a private courtyard, but it means that the standard is less. That, you know, in the house she could wear, you know, the ladies in Borough Park, they wear these like turbans, some sort of casual, I don't know, a headdress that would appear. Shmata, whatever, but in public she would have to wear something more substantial. Like in the olden days, the Rambam's example actually is that in the house and the courtyard, she's allowed to wear a kerchief that just covers her hair. But when she goes out in public, she has to wear a shawl that completely drapes over her head and body. So that's not the Rambam writes explicitly that that's not a halacha that applies in all places in all times. That applies only in
It
applies only in communities where that's the norm.
That's where he lived.
So nowadays everyone agrees a woman doesn't have to wear a complete shawl and she's allowed to wear a kerchief that just covers her hair, even outside in the public domain, assuming that that's considered to be acceptable dress.
And what exactly does it say in the Gemara about something that is the equivalent of a shetel?
A wig. So, in the times of the Gemara, the Mishnayos already mentioned a wig. We're talking about in the context of tachshitim, of adornments on Shabbos. So, there's a question that there's a concern that Chazal. I have an article coming about this.
Oh, really?
Hopefully, I haven't officially been accepted yet, but we'll be about this topic. So I'm not going to reveal all the details, but there are the sixth parak of Masechet Shabbos. One of the central themes is what a woman is allowed to wear on Shabbos and what she is not allowed to wear on Shabbos outside, because there is a concern regarding certain types of adornments that she might wear that she might take them off and the public, either because they're loose or because she's going to want to show them to someone. Something like that. So she's gonna take it off, and she's gonna take it in her hand and walk for Amos, and she's gonna carry it. That's why Chazal imposed certain restrictions on adornments in. And you'll see all the details in the article, but basically appearing in public with certain adornments. So one of the
it isn't just the carrying by wearing it itself. I thought that was also an issue with some things.
If it's a tachshit, if it's an adornment on yourself, so on a deraisa level. That's perfectly fine. It's considered to be wearing and not carrying.
Gloves, for example.
Gloves are a malbush, not a takshid. Gloves is a different issue. Gloves is a garment, but a takshid on a derice level, any type of jewelry, any type of normal thing that's worn and makes you enhances appearance or serves as an accessory to one's body, so that's permissible. That's considered wearing and not carrying. So one of the thing, but the question is that the Chazal imposed certain restrictions because you might take it off and carry it in your hand. So one of the takshitim that's mentioned in the Mishnayos over there is called a peyanachris, a wig. A foreign lock, literally. It's called peyanachris, a foreign lock. So it says that a woman is allowed to wear a peyanachris in a courtyard. We're not concerned. Presumably it means even a courtyard without an eruv in it. So even technically on a midrabbanan, you're not allowed to carry there, but okay, you're allowed to wear because of the concern that a woman without her wig will not appear pleasing to her husband. So Chazal were more lenient about a wig than other adornments. Okay, so what's a wig in the Chazal? So a wig means pashtus, that according to the vast majority of commentators, it means in the context of Chazal, it means not a wig that's worn visibly, but rather like hair that you stuff under a kerchief that makes
extensions
that it makes you look
funny things that people
it makes if a woman didn't had thin hair or something, so then she would have extensions in her hair to make it look her look more bulky under her kerchief. It wasn't something that was necessarily worn in public, right? So that's why, based on how they learned this Mishnah, and maybe it's only in the Chatzer, because the Mishnah mentions that it's in the Chatzer, which you'll see why in my upcoming article, you'll see why what the issue is with the Chatzer. But some Rishonim say that even if you assume that this is a wig, this could be applied to a wig that's worn visibly, that covers all the hair, it would only be acceptable in a Chatzer, in the courtyard, because this would be considered one of these head coverings that, yes, technically covers the hair, and therefore it's not an issue of going completely uncovered with the hair and having other men see you, but rather it's just not of the grade that would be appropriate to wear in Rishus HaRabim. Because when you go out to a really public domain, so then you need a more substantial, real serious hair covering, and a wig would not be sufficient. Others say it's irrelevant that that if you're allowed in a chatzar, you're allowed even a Rishus HaRabim with a wig, even if it's covered. And so others say, no, even in a chatzar, you see, you're only allowed a wig if it's covered by something else, and you're not. Okay, but the truth is, in my opinion, that the whole discussion regarding the Peah Nacharis in the Mishnah, even though that's the locus classicus for the discussion of the wigs in halacha regarding whether a woman is allowed to wear them, but in my analysis, the whole discussion is irrelevant because in forget the issue of Shabbos, but because regarding the issues of what a woman is allowed to wear as a proper covering, so a lot of it has to do with what is acceptable in society. Mm-hmm. What is acceptable in society. So you have a wig that technically fulfills the requirement to cover the hair, but the question is, it still looks like hair. So what are you, what exactly? Well, not your hair. It's not, you're not, you know.
The more expensive ones.
Right. So nowadays, men are used to seeing women without their heads covered. That's clear. You're allowed to, a man does not normally get more improper thoughts by looking at a woman's hair than he does looking at a woman's face or something like that. Because every woman in the street is going with their hair uncovered. So.
But every woman in the street is going in a miniskirt.
Well, hair, as you see from the fact that unmarried women, according to the accepted psak, are allowed to go with their hair uncovered.
So it's not.
That hair is not intrinsically considered a lascivious type of body part. So here, basically, the idea behind the heter, in my analysis, the idea behind the heter of sheitel nowadays is not based on its appearance in Chazal, but based on the fact that hair, the appearance of hair, does not cause anyone's eyebrows to, to rise. And so all that remains is a technical halacha that a married woman has to cover her hair. So therefore, it is acceptable for a woman to wear a sheitel, a wig, as a head covering, even in Rishus HaRabim, even outside.
Like Rabbi Ovadia Yosef.
He
made a big deal about it.
Yeah, okay. He made it. Yeah, everyone has their every great posek has their thing that they're into. So this was his thing.
Wasn't that because they were used in Avodah Zarah or something?
No, the Avodah Zarah thing came much later. No. That's a totally different thing. That's some in recent years it was discovered that a lot of hair that's used in sheitels is coming from India. Yeah. And it was used in a certain service in their temple. So the question is whether the hair constituted an offering to Avodah Zarah or not. It's a whole very, very complicated discussion. Right. If you're not, if it's really Avodah Zarah, so then you're not allowed to benefit from it. That's a major problem. Yeah, so how we solve that issue is not directly related to whether you're allowed to wear a sheitel or not. But a lot of... so in fact, it's become the opposite nowadays in a lot of circles, like in Lakewood or in Washington Heights. So... in contrast to the classical poskim who allowed sheitels, who said, well, maybe you're only allowed to wear it in your courtyard or in your house, even in front of other men, but you're not allowed to wear it in Rishus HaRabim because it's not a substantial enough covering. So it's become the opposite, that the sheitel is considered the most formal type of head covering that a woman, a good Yekesha woman, will, I mean, probably they're, nowadays they're more relaxed about it, but in the 50 years ago, 60 years ago, so a good Yekesha woman would not appear in public without a sheitel, but in her house she might wear a tichel or a snood or something like that. Yeah.
But can I back up just a second to something before it's totally away from us? You're talking about...
back to our greasy pancake here, right?
No. Back to Kesuva and what, when she gets it and when she doesn't. Like, obviously, if she's been fooling around or she's whatever... Or she traipses up the house, or she refuses to go to the mikveh, or whatever. You divorce her. I mean, I don't. One does.
She refuses to go to the mikveh is different, actually. If a woman says outright, "I'm refusing to go to the mikveh," You know, so then there's a whole complex halachic procedure that's followed that's called the moredes, that a woman who's rebelling against her husband. What the Mishnah is talking about, that she's divorced immediately without being paid her ksuba, is if it was discovered that she had been with her husband without having gone to the mikvah and she didn't tell him. Meaning that she, the, refusing to go to the mikvah, you tell him,
totally,
I'm not going.
One is
the other one is saying, oh, everything's fine, let's go. And then it was discovered later that she was in a not.
How was it discovered?
Yeah.
But we will
that, the Gemara discusses
no,
how it
was
discovered.
My question was going to be and is, supposing you get two people, the guy and the girl, you start out, your BTs, and you start out, you started out, and you've gotten to about the same place and you from kite-wise, and you get married, and then one of you, the husband, say, takes off and gets what the other one thinks is crazy for him and wants to, you know, take on 59 different homeroos or whatever it is, and she's not in such a rush to get quite that from quite so fast. What's the point at which he can slash or should divorce her or what?
No, in that situation, where the woman is adhering to a recognized standard of halacha, okay, even if it's not to the chumras that her husband wants. So then, if they want to get divorced, then he absolutely would have to pay her ksuba. That's no question.
Reassuring.
Yeah.
Why does it make sense for my daughter to grow her hair long, cut the hair, make a shetel, and someone else is allowed to wear that hair?
According to some poskim, a woman herself is allowed to grow her hair long, cut it off, and wear it as her own shetel.
Really?
If it's not attached to your head, so it's not considered. Look, I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I believe, as I laid out my logic before, that al pi halacha nowadays, that it's not the hair is not considered to be alluring. It is mutter according to halacha for a woman to wear sheitel even in public. But I also think that perhaps that Klal Yisrael, the women in Klal Yisrael, should voluntarily be trying to return to a more authentic standard. That perhaps, you know, nowadays, you know, a lot of the shetel thing had to do with the fact that in Western society it became viewed as informal to wear some sort of head covering. That it was only considered to be formal if a woman appeared in public with her her head uncovered. If you look at, for example, take someone who dresses very old-fashioned, Queen of England. Okay, mm-hmm. Queen of England, during the day, not to less formal engagements, she wears hats. Mm-hmm. But in the evening engagements, it's not the hats are considered not formal, so she goes with her head uncovered, maybe with a tiara or something like that.
Diamonds, yeah.
Right,
but she's the queen.
Mm-hmm. I understand, but not just the queen; it would be all upper class ladies would be doing similar things. So hats are considered less formal nowadays, which is why part of this goyisha mentality that sunk into Klal Yisrael, that the most formal type of thing is if a woman looks as if she's not covering her hair. But the Torah says a woman should cover her hair, so we should, you know, nowadays we have Muslims who very proudly wear different types of headscarves, and especially in Eretz Yisrael, you know, where the whole society should be based on Judaism and the Torah, so you don't need this workaround anymore, in my opinion. So the women of Klal Yisrael should now be voluntarily trying to return to the standard that they don't wear shetels. But again, they don't seem to be listening to me.
Jewish women marry out men or women.
We're talking about Orthodox. We're talking about Orthodox, yeah.
Yeah, actually, Rav Moshe, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there's a tshuva from an Ungarisha Rav, you know, who said, I think that my wife, you know, should be required to follow my minhag and shave her hair off and wear a wig. So he said,
no shetel.
Whatever the Ungarisha thing is, right? I think it was a shetel and then a tefillah or something like that.
Yeah.
And so he said, excuse me. He says, it's none of your business. Rosemary says, you know, it is her mitzvah, and if she is covering her head in appropriate fashion, al pi halacha, then that she can do it in any way she chooses, and you know, and you have nothing to say about it.
That's correct. Rav Moshe did say that, but of course that would only apply if they were living in a community where it was accepted to wear shetel. If you're living in a heterogeneous community in Brooklyn, so then she wouldn't be looked at askance. But if you move to Kiryas Yoel or something,
whether your hair has been shaved off under the shelf.
Oh, mikveh lady can.
What?
The mikveh lady can. That's how they do it. In Kiryas Yoel, if they do, uh, if they, Yeah, that in the Kiryas Yoel, where you have a very tight community grip on the community. So the mikveh lady reports to the rabbanim if a woman shows up at the mikveh with hair. But the shaving the head is a totally different thing. That's a new thing. That you look in the Chakira actually recently, a couple issues ago, I think, had an article, maybe even the one where I wrote my last article, but it was how the Sadmar Rav, when he was very strongly trying to push that all married women should shave their heads, not just cover their hair. So the way he made it out to be is this was the original Ashkenazi practice, and it was just the modernizing influences where the women started to grow their hair long. So this article debunks that claim, and it's obvious, even the Sadmar Rav would agree, you know, there's absolutely no question whatsoever that in the times of Chazal and the Gemara, so women had long hair. That was certainly not in not under dispute at all.
You cannot cover your hair if you have
not. Well, you still have to cover your head, even if a woman has no hair. She still has to wear.
Yeah, cover.
And the real the din is really to cover your head. You know, the hair is a manifestation of the head. But
so you don't think at all in terms of if it's a shekel, you can't tell it's covered.
They're two different things. Even according to me, that I state very clearly that according to the halacha nowadays, a shetel is mutter. Even if I don't think it's the ideal state of the Jewish people, I say al pi din is mutter. There are restrictions that if the shetel is absolutely indistinguishable from uncovering the head, then that's usur because of the mitzvah v'yis and nikiyim, that you can't look as if you're doing an isur. And somebody who knows what to look for if you have a shetel, so you could tell that, especially in the front, that it doesn't attach to her head.
Sometimes.
Rav Moshe said, well, right. You know, men can't tell, women always can.
Okay, there's a svara like that. There's a svara like that. There's a story, a famous story. Rabbi Willig is very, very into this idea that he says, apparently when people ask him, I don't know if people ask him the shaila, but he says, the shetel, you're allowed to wear a shetel, but I have to be able to tell that it's a shetel. That's his standard. So apparently, I heard a story that he had a daughter-in-law who was marrying into the family. They weren't married yet. So apparently her family was very wealthy. So they used to order their shetels from this one particular wig maker who worked in Hollywood and who, you know, was just like the best in the world. Shetels cost an inordinate amount of money. So when her mother took her to her shetel appointment to this Spitz wig maker, she says to him, oh, so just so you know, before we begin with the fitting, my future father-in-law says that it can't be so good. You have to be able to tell a little bit that it's wig. And she said the guy was like totally floored that anyone would make this request.
Like, reputation. I can't do a wig like that.
Right. So that's one restriction. Has to be able to be, you have to be able to tell that it's a shetel. It can't be 100% indistinguishable. That's number one. It also has to be, and this is, I think, is a Dover Pashid, which is very much not adhered to by many societies nowadays, including Nebrak even, that it has to be in a modest hairstyle. Mm-hmm. It can't be in a more preetzistic hairstyle than would be for even a single girl. So if you have a shetel, she was single, she was wearing her hair in a very modest fashion, and all of a sudden she gets married, and she wears a shetel that's you know, waves in it down to her waist. That's a very big problem. I don't understand why people are not more makbid on that.
It's better if a woman covers her head with a kerchief or with a hat than if she wears a shetel.
Well, it's obvious.
Of course, it's better. Yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure, it's better.
A hat. Yeah, a hat shows some hair.
You better.
The question is how much and how much.
Rabbi Feinstein's wife did not wear a shetel. She wore.
I have never seen a picture of her, you know, with a different hair covering besides a shetel. There are plenty of pictures of her in the art school biography, and she's always wearing a shetel and all that. No. There's no picture of her in the art school biography with a hat.
With a shetel and a hat.
No shetel and hat. Chassidim do that. Some Chassidim do that. They cover their, they use a shetel, but then just to make it very clear that their woman is intending to cover her hair, that she's married, she's recognizably married, so she wears a hat or a tichel on top of that.
About the shetel, talking about having a pretty good shetel, I mean, now that women can be
dominant, it could be an attractive shetel. It doesn't have to look bad. It just has to look, it can't look voluptuous and alluring.
Right.
That's what my point.
Like shmata either.
Okay. Right.
But they're not so much nowadays, perhaps, but there used to be a lot of form women who taught in public school.
Yeah.
And you can't wear a hat in public school.
Nowadays you can, with all the Muslims, and you'll sue them for discrimination.
I'm 40 years.
That's why I say we should return to no shetels, but yeah.
I'm talking 40 years.
Yeah.
But
there are different shitas regarding how much. We discussed the quality, but in terms of the quantity, so the question...
What?
Hair that you have to cover. So the question is, you have to cover all of it, or are you allowed to leave a little bit out? But there are hats that cover basically all, with just a little bit sticking out. And if you're basically... It's pretty explicit in the Shulchan Aruch, although some will be machmir even on this, but it's pretty explicit in the Shulchan Aruch that if you wear a covering that is intended to cover all your hair, that just, you know, fits completely around your head, and a little bit of hair just sticks out sort of unintentionally, then that is permissible. The question is, are you allowed to... So that answers the question about the hat. You're definitely, you know... But chassidim, based on the Zohar, are very makpid that every single strand of hair should be covered. The Zohar says it brings bracha into the house, etc. But you could imagine being more makel because, based on the Gemara, again, this idea of what it says that on a deraisa level or in the chotzer or something, a lesser quality hair covering is allowed. So the question is, does the lesser quality hair covering still cover all the hair, which is not a formal covering, or does it not cover all the hair? So, according to the idea that on a deraisa level, even a hair covering that does not cover all the hair is good, but only be the rabbanan or because of the minhag, you need a more comprehensive hair covering, a complete hair covering. So you could argue that in a Jewish community where the woman, where the women, you know, have reversed this minhag, that they that the practice in that community is that they don't cover all their hair; they just wear a hair head covering that covers most of their head or something like that. And they let some hair show. An argument could be made that that is justifiable, even if it might not be the ideal. There is an ideal that it's possible that is justifiable.
Is it true that the Ramah says you could have a whole fistful of hair show?
No, the Ramah doesn't say that.
Ramah said a tefach.
Right. Ramah said right. Ramah Feinstein has a short tshuva, which is
how do you know?
Very convoluted logic. It's a very interesting tshuva, where he has this whole cheshbin. You know, it's like what we were talking about last time with covering your hair after the chuppah. That maybe you don't have to. According to Rav Moshe, a woman doesn't completely have to cover her hair until the next morning after the wedding, because since a woman could not be brought as a sota until she had slept with her husband at least once. Mm-hmm. So in Mela, since we learn it out from Sota, okay. So a woman does not need to cover her hair, at least not fully, until she slept with her husband at least once, or at least has the presumption of being slept with him at least once. So
the Yechud doesn't count then?
According to many poskim, a Yechud, a woman would have to cover her hair completely after the Yechud, after she's fully a Nesua. She's uh-huh. fully married, irrespective of that. Uh-huh. Question is, I was pointing out last time, is, you know, how much do you take it as a technical equivalence to the laws of Sota? How much you take it as more of a general thing, like, since you learned it out from the Sota, that this is no good, so therefore Jewish women have to be modest, and therefore once they're married, they have to cover their hair. So Rav Moshe was into this idea, same thing as, she doesn't really have to cover it until the day after. That there's a technical equivalent. So he said, since it's learned out from the fact that you uncover the sota's head, so you could still, even if she were uncovering some of her hair, but she was covering most of her head, so uncovering it could still be called uncovering, as opposed to if she were covering only partially her head, so then she'd basically be considered to be uncovered already, so taking it off more wouldn't be considered further uncovering. So he said, based on that, you see that the head just in general has to be mostly covered, and since we have this rule of tefach, by, for example, if you are reciting Kriya Shema and a woman's body in a place that she normally covers is uncovered less than a tefach, then you're still allowed to recite Kriya Shema in front of that woman. So, okay, it's a shiloh that applies to your wife, only, whatever, okay, but whatever it is. So he says, since we have this shear of a tefach, and you see you don't have to cover all of your hair... Mm-hmm. So, therefore, a woman is allowed to uncover less than a tefach of her hair. Rav Avadi Yosef also accepts this. Whatever, it's it's very it's a little bit too convoluted. You would assume that if you have to cover your hair, either it goes according to the minhag, or you have to cover all of your hair. I don't. It's a little bit too technical to go to this exact shear somewhere in the middle.
Well, they managed to do it as far as covering your arms is concerned, because there too he says up to a tefach above your elbow.
Ramosha doesn't say that explicitly, no. I don't know, maybe he held that, but...
The Ramah.
No. The Ramah is talking about b'dievet, if a woman's uncovering it, if you're allowed, still allowed to recite Kirishma. That's a different discussion. But the... Anyway, so that's Rav Moshe here. So a lot of women follow this. So I would say, okay, so if you don't hold, you have to cover all of your hair. And if you hold it, it goes according to the minag. So then Rav Moshe here is sort of a chumra. Because you could imagine maybe you'd be allowed to uncover even more. But a lot of poskim think that Rav Moshe's logic is too convoluted. And covering the hair means you have to cover all of your hair.
Rav Moshe, are you talking about Rav Feinstein?
Yeah.
I'm talking about Rav Moshe.
The Rama doesn't mention anything besides the shear that I mentioned before, which is that if you wear a head covering that basically is designed to cover all of your hair, but a little bit hair sticks out, then that's okay.
And he doesn't talk about the quantity there.
Besides for that, no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look. These rules being formulated as explicit, you know, chapter and verse, you have to do this, and you have to do this, and you have to do this, is a very new thing. In the olden days, this wasn't an issue. Jewish women was passed from mother to daughter. This is a general society was much more modest in terms of how they dressed. It wasn't an issue that you had to discuss these things. The woman just covered their hair with whatever covering was normal in that place, and that was... That was it. It's only with modernity that you have these explicit discussions of exactly is this allowed, exactly is this not allowed. Da, 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 da. It's become much more of an issue recently. Okay. Just keep doing what you're doing. It's good. Okay. So the...
there you go.
So the... fine. Mishor Shea Mitzvah. So what's the reason that a... That's the korban of the sota does not have oil. Amar Rabbi Zeinu Zichronam Levracha, Kedei Shel Yeh Korban Mehudar Shemekori, or Vehi Asta Bachoshech. That, according to the Medrash, it's because oil also represents light, because we use it to light lamps, candles. And she did things that were hidden in the darkness, so therefore she doesn't get light in her korban. Vehasta Maise Behema. She acted like an animal that she was not particular about her sexual partners, which is, so that's like an animal. And that's also why the korban is barley instead of wheat, because animals eat barley and people eat wheat.
Oh my.
Okay. Tell that to cholent, you know. People love barley in their cholent, but barley bread... it was generally only eaten by animals, and people preferred wheat, even though we know that barley is one of the five species of grain. And if you do bake bread out of it, then you will have to wash, make hamotzi, you have to bench, you're yotzei matzah with it on Pesach. But nevertheless, fundamentally, in general, it's considered to be a animal feed. The Ramban in his commentary on Chumash gave a simple understanding. So the husband has to pay for this korban because it's one of his ways of requesting God that he take revenge against this woman if she really strayed. V'tam haseorim shetia saras Hashem chama yotza v'sar mischol arosh harisha azona yachol. That seorim, that the korban has to be barley, so seorim sounds like sa'ara, not really the same shorish, no, not hair, it means, yeah, it's also like hair, you're right, but it also means like storm, so you want the anger of God to descend like a storm on this woman who behaved so improperly. Uche'inyen, tzlil seorim ha'amor b'gidon, shepasro so l'sara muhum araba. That there's a story in the book of Shoftim that they were in the middle of a battle, and one of the people who was involved in the battle had a dream about barley. So it was interpreted at the time to mean that there was going to be a big disturbance in the camp of the enemy, and even though it was just barley, but it sounded like storm, so it was going to be a disturbance.
Shen and Sen, right?
Right. V'chein b'chli cheres, Simen shetishaver kichli yotzer, that the reason that the water that is going to form the drink of the sota is put specifically into an earthenware vessel is a sign that you want the woman to break, just like earthenware vessels break easily. And the reason you have to take an allusion of the fact that you have to take some of the ground from of the base of Mikdash and put it into the drink is a sign that you want her to die and be buried and return to dust. But the Ramban, he has wrote these other allusions about the details of the sota procedure, but he did not talk about the oil. And the Sefer Chinuch says, well, I'm going to suggest something. Yeshemen Elyon al kol amashkin shutzaf al kulan. Oil is the highest of all the liquids. Literally, you mix it together with another liquid, the oil will be on top. Ve'ata hasota shekilkala maaseh v'yasira baila migvira v'nasna lemata b'sheif elu vizyon. So her husband is now reducing her from the status she had as the lady of the house to being degraded in such a manner. Ein roi lavi bekarbana shemen anichba junachon leora veli gidula lemashch ulu veli gidula lemashcha bo hamalachin vakohanim agedolim. So this type of oil, which is the highest of all liquids, and it's used for such important purposes to provide illumination and to anoint the major officials of the Jewish people, like the kings and the high priests, so you shouldn't have her associated with oil at all. That it's just trying to get us to think about the fact that if people sin and they do behave improperly, so they're not going to be on high, they're going to eventually end up low. So that God will act generously to those who act well, and they will be happy, as opposed to the sota who was very unhappy. It's explained in the Chumash. I don't have to go in great detail. It only applies in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, because the sota is only done when the court of 71 elders is in session. And that was only in the Beis HaMikdash in its proper, I mean, it existed afterwards, but in its proper iteration, it was only in the chamber of hewn stone in the Beis HaMikdash. The kohen over al zeviyotzak shemen v'mincha sota over al lav v'lokes. So if a kohen puts oil in the mincha of the sota, then he will receive a penalty of lashes because he violated a negative commandment. Shelo lahasim mitzvah shin samech zayin mitzvah 367. Not to put frankincense in the korban of the sota either. That shelo hasim levona b'korban sota shenamar velo yitein alav levona. You shouldn't put frankincense. Mishor sheha mitzvah kini mashik asavti b'shem. And it's similar to what I wrote about the oil. Kelavona hidor b'korban v'reach tov. That it makes the korban of a higher quality and gives it a nice fragrance. Lachein ein roi l'isha chotez lahadir korbana. So if a woman has sinned, then it's not proper for her to get such a nice, pleasing, pleasant korban.
The old Amr is the one that gets the
carbon. What?
Is she the one that?
Yeah, but it represents her. No. She doesn't get it. Just burnt on the mizbeach, but it represents her.
Right.
That, you know, while it's being made and everything, if they put oil and frankincense, it's just incongruous. You have this woman who's, you know, has her garments ripped and her hair disheveled, and all of a sudden the Kohen says, oh, this is such a lovely korban. It just doesn't stem. That our ancestors, our foremothers, are compared to frankincense. Shenemar, as we darshan for the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, vel givas halevona, and we're coming to a hill of frankincense. Vizo persha midarchehen, that this woman who's coming to be sotaified has left the way that was taught to us by our righteous foremothers, And therefore, it's not appropriate to have anything such as frankincense that's associated with the four mothers in her korban. Umitzvah zo gamken mevoris bakasu, that this mitzvah is also explained in detail in the Chumash. So it's, we explained it before, so we do not need to go at length in explaining it.